There's nothing to fear except fear itself. An appropriate quote leading into a discussion on the illusion of life and death, the title of Claire Goldsberry's book. I'm Robin, and you're listening to Tributaries. Or you will be if you stay tuned. Claire, although it could be said any book written is written from an entire lifetime, when did you write The Illusion of Life and Death in reference to your husband's passing?
I wrote it over a period of about 5 years, actually. It started out as a kind of a journal of Brent's illness, his esophageal cancer diagnosis, and during the 18 months between when he was diagnosed and when he died. So that sort of turned into an exploration of death and dying. I volunteered for hospice for a couple of years after Brent's death, and that also gave me personal insights into the difficulties that people have with a terminal diagnosis, with the death process, and with death itself. And so I thought, well, maybe this book would give people some insights from ancient sages, philosophers, various religious and spiritual traditions, and even quantum physics into what is life and what is death.
Yes, and would you say that you and your husband shared a similarly conscious path regarding his passing?
We did not share a similar path. He had no religious viewpoints, didn't even know anything about Buddhism until he and I met. So I think he had a very fearless life, but that was just the way he was. It was like he was just born fearless. He was just born knowing that this is life, and things didn't bother him at all. Which I found interesting, especially when he received his diagnosis. It really shocked me, but it did not shock him in any way. He just commented, well, this should be another excellent adventure. And so off we went.
Right. And it's interesting to hear you say that you didn't think you did because he didn't have any kind of spiritual background. Whereas in seeing your book, I thought it was very similar, and just the fact that he was fearless and accepted. I mean, what is life except accepting what is and moving
right.
forward, right? And it doesn't matter if you know the Buddhist sage words or the Christianity or any of that, right?
That's very true. I often would say something to him, and he would make a comment, and I would go, that's a very Buddhist way of thinking, because that's what I had been learning and studying. And ultimately, it's very true. There are a lot of things we can learn from many spiritual traditions.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be one tradition, one way of thinking. The goal is to live a fearless life and to have a good death. And people get there by many paths, just like Brent did. It was not a specific religious or spiritual tradition because he didn't think like that. I guess it's just the way he figured out life on his own. So he lived it. He lived what he knew.
Yes. And you jump right in with your first chapter, Why Don't We Know How to Die? And the reasons cited are many, but what have you found is key to knowing how to die? And perhaps first on the list would be what we've just been speaking about, right?
Right, right. Well, I think it's really key to know what is life, and it's key how we live. And I think that we don't know how to die because of the fear, and I think that's what we were just talking about is the fearlessness and how to live without fear. So I think that knowing how to live involves knowing what is life, what is the phenomenal world. And we can go into a lot of different things from the Buddhist and Hindu standpoints that lead us to quantum physics and what is reality, what is the phenomenal world except that which is created in our own mind. And we create everything in the mind. Everything is created in the mind by the mind, and nothing has any inherent reality from its own side. And that's both an Eastern philosophical viewpoint as well as a quantum physics viewpoint. So I think it's important to know how we live, what is life, how do we create the phenomenal world, to know that we also create the fears that we have, like in the Harry Potter movie, you know, the ridiculous magic spell. Things come up that you're afraid of, just point at it and shout, ridiculous, and it goes away. Because most of our fears are not founded in rational thinking. And I think that's the most detrimental idea to why we fear death. We fear death because we don't know what life is. Ultimately, we don't know how to die, and we don't know what death is. And that's something that's very difficult to wrap our head around, because we think that maybe it's the end. Some people believe there is nothing after we die. People believe in various things about after we die, where do we go, if we go anywhere in the sense of going, or, you know, do we create our life after death in the same way we create our life before death?
Right. And so to ask that question almost seems like a rabbit hole that would be better spent going to the beach or going skiing in the mountains or something. You know, it's like, let's be here. And in talking about the illusion of reality, basically, which includes life and death, of course, what do you think is key? I mean, it's one thing to allow it for yourself, but it's another to allow it for another.
To allow anyone to live the life that they need to live, I think allowing someone's karma, I think we have to look at karma. Reincarnation in the Eastern philosophies are two sides of this coin. And I think you have to allow people's karma to play out as it will. You know, in Buddhist traditions, we have this saying, which we learned at the Sangha that I had gone to for several years, and that is, death is certain, the time of our death is uncertain. One of the keys to living a good life is remember death. And that's kind of this thing that we keep in our minds, remember death, because death will happen. We don't know when, we don't know how. Brent one time told a coworker, when she questioned how he could be so happy when he knew he was going to die. And he said, well, you know, what's not to be happy about? He said, I know about when I'm going to die, and I know what I'm going to die of. So he said, that takes all the mystery out of it for me. And this is my path. You know, he truly believed that this was his path. And I think, to quote a Pema Chodron saying that I heard years ago, you know, embrace all as the path. And I've often thought of that. Embrace all as the path. Are we capable of that? No, we have a lot of resistance because we get attached to things. You know, we don't like the idea that all things are impermanent. We think everything should be permanent. It should be real and here and right now. But it's not. So if we can embrace all as the path, knowing that that path is filled with things we don't want, as well as things we want, but that we shouldn't get attached to, because all is impermanent.
Yes, yes, certainly. And you brought up reincarnation and karma just now, and there was a man, Mr. Storm, who you quoted in your book, and he was saying that karma is God's justice. And I think that's such a huge fallacy. And you followed up with a similar thought about that, because, you know, that's just more laying blame in a sense, isn't it?
Not really.
No,
not really. I think we have to understand that the word karma just means action, and all actions have consequences. And I often refer to karma, not particularly as God's justice, because now we go down this rabbit hole of, you know, what is God? Who is God? Is God an anthropomorphic being like me, or is it, you know, something else? I think it is perfect justice. And I think looking at it in the way that the Eastern philosophies look at it, and that is, we have created, all of us have created the life that we have. A lot of our life that we have today began to be created in our previous lives. And it will continue. The life we have today will have an influence on the life we have in our reincarnations. And I think it's interesting that it's not just people who practice or believe in an Eastern philosophical tradition, but more and more just regular people who maybe have even been raised Christian or Jewish often believe in reincarnation. The Pew Research Group, who does, they perform a lot of different surveys every year on religion and public life. And I kind of follow those, I follow them for years, surveys, and look at how people do believe in reincarnation. And karma is very much a part of it. It's the flip side of the reincarnation. In other words, you can't have one without the other. In a class I teach on it, I tell it, it's like love and marriage. You know, you can't have one without the other. Karma and reincarnation is the same way. So I think it's not placing blame. That's often very misleading. And because all of us are in a very, very real way responsible for our actions, body, speech, and mind. We have, you know, all of those things, body, speech, and mind. Our thoughts create, you know, they can create consequences.
Absolutely.
Our
yes.
actions always create consequences. You know, our speech creates consequences. So it's learning to be mindful of everything that we do, knowing that everything will have a consequence. And people think karma is like retribution or
right.
oh,
and
you got
that is the first
because you,
yes,
you
that
know,
is
you did something. That's not true. That's not true.
Right. And the way karma is interpreted these days is exactly that. And so I think it's great to bring up that, oh, karma means action. And it's not, yeah, I mean, here's another rabbit hole that we can pontificate on forever. But it's also an interesting perspective to give us a kind of safety. And I'm not saying you were seeking safety. You were seeking what is true for me. And you have, you know, you have certainly lived and researched many different traditions, ancient wisdom traditions, religions, and have you zeroed in on the one that makes the most sense to you? Not obviously from your book, The Illusion of Life and Death. You're not discounting any of them. Everything has its richness to share with us. But is there a certain tradition that you feel like this one is for me? It speaks to me.
Well, I think that would be Buddhism, and of course, Buddhism grew out of Hinduism, so, and I've spent the last few years studying Hindu philosophy, and I think that that, for me, gave a lot of answers. I think the Eastern philosophies can provide a lot of answers to things that, as a Christian growing up, there were no answers to. That's just the way it is. You know, oh, sure, God loves everybody equally, but why was I born under such good circumstances and somebody else was born into such terrible negative circumstances?
Okay, so how do you explain that one then, from the Christian and from the Buddhist or the Eastern?
Well, you know, in Christianity, I think there's really no answer. Well, that's just the way it is. There's no answer because life begins the minute you're born and it ends the minute you die. So there's nothing that makes any sense. You know, why do bad things happen to good people? It's the same thing.
Okay, so how does a Buddhist?
There's no real answer to it, you know.
How does a Buddhist answer that, or a Eastern philosophy?
Well, a
Buddhist
would answer that in that, first of all, we judge things good or bad. Bad things happen. Well, how do we know it was bad? You know, a year ago, my daughter lost her job, and it was just, and there was, it was a lot of office, you know, stuff going on. It was
sure.
just a lot of different things. And so, you know, she was the scapegoat and she got fired. And when she called me crying about, oh, she lost her job, you know, and I told her, I said, well, you know, but it's, don't judge it as a bad thing right now.
Right.
It may be the best thing that ever happened to you.
Yes. Good for you.
And so after she kind of got over it, and she and a friend who she had worked with started their own business doing what they'd been doing for 20 years. And now they're finding some success with their own business. And now she says, you're right, Mom, it was the best thing that ever happened.
Yes. I have a favorite story about the Chinese farmer. And after everything that happened, he would always say, I don't know if this is good or bad. I must just wait and see.
So that's very good. That's very good. You have to get some distance, I think.
Yes, yes.
And I think this idea of judging things good or bad really hinders us. It's a real
It's
obstacle.
The start of it all, isn't it? Creating the opposite.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's where all this began, I think.
Yes, yes. And so the first time that I opened a book, which was The Way of Zen by Alan Watts, and I opened it because I was putting this book on my shelf, and I'd owned the book for like 20 years, and it never made any sense to me.
I love those stories,
I tried
yes.
reading it.
Yes.
Yeah. And it fell on my foot. I was putting things up, you know, my books, rearranging a shelf in a new house I just bought, and it was like, okay, I picked it up, I opened it, and I read one paragraph, and I said, oh my goodness, this is it.
Right.
This is it. And that started me off in another direction.
Beautiful. Claire, share something about the Buddhist philosophy of dying having two phases, the outer dissolution when the senses and elements dissolve, and the inner solution in which the senses and elements dissolve.
Well, there is a process to dying, and I think that's very important. I think it would be important for everybody to understand this process. Not everybody gets to go through all these processes and the different stages. Some people are killed in accidents that you know, they're killed instantly. But the process for people who are in the dying phases, the outer processes, I think, are the, you know, the way the body becomes thin, the body becomes cold, the heat goes from the extremities and centers in the core. That's because, you know, you might feel somebody's foot and they're very cold, but they don't feel cold. In fact, they may feel very hot. They lose the water. They begin, you know, drooling heavily. And that's difficult to watch. Even though I had my Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by my side and reading about these processes, it's still difficult to watch.
Sure.
And being able to give them ice chips because they are becoming so dry. They lose the fluids in the body. And the inner process of how the inner winds gather. They gather and they move upward through the central channel. The central channel is not a physical channel. It's a metaphysical channel that goes up, and ultimately we exit through the top of our head, the mind or the soul. Christianity calls it the soul. When I found out that soul was just another word for mind in the Greek sense, the Greek language, I thought that makes perfect sense. Now I understand soul, and that moves up and out through the top of one's head as it entered through the top of our head when we were conceived. So I think that it's an interesting process. I think if you know that process, it makes it very easy to help someone have a good death by allowing them to go through this.
Yes.
In fact, I do believe there is value in the dying process for those who go through this process.
Of course, yes. And to quote a friend of mine, death and dying are spiritual matters, not necessarily medical ones. And sudden death is treated as the worst thing that could ever happen oftentimes. And I wonder if you could speak to all of those who are holding on like that.
Well, I think that it's the holding on is the attachment that we have. It's the attachment we have to our loved ones. It's the attachment we have to life. I think there's so many people that believe that life is all there is. I know it's difficult in the medical field for doctors to let go. I mentioned Dr. Kevin Hasselhorst in the book, who says that it's so difficult even for doctors to acknowledge that death is a spiritual process, and it's not a horrible failure on the part of the medical system, as so many believe it is. You know, this idea of you're not going to die on my watch, kind of a thing that Dr. Hasselhorst says is so prevalent. It is a spiritual process, and I think that to embrace this as one of Brent's doctors did. He attended a conference at the Mayo Clinic here in Scottsdale. They had a Buddhist monk come and talk about death and dying. And this doctor had gone there because he knew us and knew, you know, of this philosophy. And he said it helped him so much understand that it is not just a physical process. Death is not a physical failure of being able to save someone's life. Death is a spiritual process, and it's very important for all of us to understand that.
Yes, and it's wonderful that depending on your bent or where you want to focus in life, it's addressed beautifully in so many different ways. Science moving into quantum physics has its version, and it all definitely points in the same direction. So it might be a difficult thing to take in, but it's not a difficult thing to find. And I would venture to say we all find it at the right moment when it's needed.
Oh, I believe that. Yes, for sure.
I think it's so important to recognize the different levels of consciousness in all of this. And one thing that's, you know, you could call it curious, you could call it comical, you could call it many things, but you experienced more than once, didn't you? Your husband coming out of a different consciousness and saying, oh, am I dead yet? Or am I dead?
Right. Right. And I think that is important to remember that there isn't just one level of consciousness. There are many levels of consciousness that we experience in, you know, waking consciousness, a dream consciousness, a deep sleep that we don't have a consciousness that we're aware of, all of those things. And the dying process also contains, I think, different levels of consciousness as people sink down into the realm of where they're getting ready to leave their bodies, where often Brent wasn't sure exactly where he was, and he would call my name because we had a hospital bed set up in the family room, and I'd be back here in my office working, and he would call to me, and I would go out and you know, yes, what can I do for you? He's like, am I dead yet? And I go, no, not yet. In fact, if you have to ask me whether or not you're dead, you're probably not dead.
Yes.
And he would just smile, you know. But there were times when he was on other levels of consciousness, like he would be pointing over there, like over there is more beautiful, over there, kind of a thing. And then he would kind of come out of it. And in fact, one time he said, well, I guess if I'm not dead, I can watch hockey. That was his favorite thing. So, and it was the hockey playoff season.
Oh,
so,
nice. Yeah.
You know, so it was rather interesting to see that he was on different levels of consciousness throughout this process.
Yeah. Well, it's really quite wonderful and fortunate, obviously, for both of you, but for him in particular to have had someone so willing to go along with his program, because ultimately that's something we certainly all would like, I'm sure.
Yes, for sure. Sometimes we just have to go with the flow.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Embrace all of the path.
Right, yeah. And may all time be sometimes.
Yeah, there you go.
So I'm wondering, in writing this book and having it published, what effect did this book have on you? And you can talk on any level you want to at this point.
Well, I think that personally, it was cathartic. They often say that writers write because they have a question they want to answer for themselves, or or an emotional solution that they want to resolve. And I think in many ways that's true. And I also felt that it was important because I did see so many problems as people dealt with death and dying and illness, and why do bad things happen to good people? And the whole idea of how we cannot die well in the Western world, and why it seems easier for people in the Eastern world to embrace death and dying. And so for me, it allowed me to share with everyone who reads the book maybe some thoughts that will capture their way of thinking and think, wow, that would make life easier. That would make death easier. I'm just glad to have written the book and gotten it out there. Hopefully that it will help people understand what Brent ultimately said to me, his last words to me a couple of hours before he died. And he said, dying is so easy. I thought it would be harder than this, but it's not. It's just so easy. And I would hope that people would somehow be able to capture that a little bit.
There is that being a witness to death that really needs growth as well, because we need to know and be able to let these people go and not put our own fears on them.
Right. To keep our own ego out of it. I know in the hospice classes, they said a lot of times families stand around and don't die, stay here. I can't live without you. And this idea of inserting our own ego into someone's path makes it more difficult for both people, actually, for the dying and for the loved one.
Yes, absolutely.
I think it's important to get to that point, to live fearlessly and to die fearlessly, and to be able to have a good life and a good death.
Thank you to Claire Goldsberry. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are where you'd expect to find them, and if not, do let us know. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.